what you think. You should become a Protestant for a while and get married and become a priest.
Okay, we're on Apologetics 2, Lecture number 17. Last week we talked about basically the case for creation. We said that the creation model is more plausible when you examine the origin of the universe, the origin of first life, and the origin of new life forms, more complex life forms. And so we concluded that the creation science is more plausible than the evolutionary model. Now what we want to look at is basically the case against evolution. We saw the case for creation, the case against evolution. A lot of this is repetitious, and then a lot of it just will slam evolution, but the slams against evolution are not necessarily additional points for creationism. But this is the case against evolution. And so we're going to deal with the heading at the bottom of page, AP10, Major Problems with Evolution. First problem, energy conservation, the first law of thermodynamics. That tells us that the amount of energy in the universe remains constant. That means, you know, some guys will take this and say that proves that creation could not have happened. That's ludicrous. All that energy conservation tells us, all, for that matter, all that science tells us for the most part, is about what's going on. And in other words, it tells us the amount of energy, no energy is now being created or destroyed, okay? That when you combine the first law of thermodynamics with the second law of thermodynamics, that tells us that there had to at one time have been a creation. Okay, we'll get to that when we look at the second law of thermodynamics. But energy conservation, the amount of energy in the universe remains constant. No new energy is now being created or destroyed. So therefore, whatever, it would mean one of two things, energy conservation. It would mean either the universe is eternal and is in a static state, okay? Or it would mean that if the universe came into existence, whatever process or act that brought it into existence is no longer in operation today, okay? In other words, if creation was an eternal process, an ongoing process, we would see new energy being created in the universe today, okay? But that's not the case. No energy is being created or destroyed. It's the constant, the same amount of energy. But when you combine that with the second law of thermodynamics, the next page, energy deterioration, we find that even though the amount of energy in the universe remains constant, the amount of usable energy in the universe is running down. So energy remains, the amount of energy remains constant, but when it changes forms, and when it changes forms, it becomes less and less usable. That basically tells us that we're eventually going to reach a point when all the energy in the universe is going to, it will not be usable, okay? Which also means if you go backwards in time, you would eventually reach a point where all the energy in the universe was usable. That is what the creationists would call the moment of creation. But since because of energy deterioration, we see that the universe will have an end. Since it's going to have an end, it had to have a beginning. Therefore, what we call nature, the universe, needs a cause that transcends nature, and that which transcends nature is what we call supernatural. That's all it means. So nature needs a supernatural cause. Now, the Big Bang model and the expansion of the universe also confirm the beginning of the universe. So we talked about that, I believe, last week. Since from nothing, nothing comes, it's pretty evident something outside the universe had to bring it into existence. Okay, so keep in mind the second law of thermodynamics. Once you combine that with the first law of thermodynamics, it demands the beginning of the universe. Okay, the evolutionary dating methods are inconsistent and unreliable. They're based on the principle of uniformitarianism. Now, I don't know if anybody here has had algebra, and even I believe trigonometry touches on this as well, but you'll end up, sometimes you'll get 2A plus 3B plus 2C equals, you know, such and such. Well, if there's a way to determine what the A is and what the C is, then you can figure out through that equation what the B is, okay? The problem is, with the evolutionary dating system, they assume that there is a constant rate of decay. The processes that are going on right now have been going on at the same rate throughout all time, okay? By making that assumption, they're assuming that one of their variables, one of their A's, B's, or C's, that they know what that is. So they just insert that into their equation. But that's an assumption. They have not proven it. They have to assume that there was no worldwide catastrophes for that to be correct. They have to assume that there was no creation by God. They have to assume that there was no worldwide flood. Then they assume, because there were no worldwide catastrophes, these processes go on, continue on and on. 2 Peter chapter 3, by the way, talks about that scenario. In the last days there would be mockers who would mock the second coming of Christ, and that they would say, ever since the fathers fell asleep, everything has continued one day after another, and nothing supernatural has occurred. But so they make this assumption, and it's never been proven. In fact, there's a lot of evidence to go against it. Number one, not all dating methods give astronomically old ages of the Earth or of the universe. Well,
even those which do disagree with each other.
Yeah, and the ones that do disagree with each other. So that tells us that something that is considered a constant is in fact not a constant. Then we do know that there are certain processes that at times reverse themselves throughout history. So the uniformitarianism, that principle is a weak principle. Rocks known to have been only a few hundred years old have been dated to be hundreds of millions of years old. Dr. Henry Morris of the Institute of Creation Research has stated that there's many different ways to date the Earth's age, but evolutionists only use those methods which give astronomically old dates, since evolution needs millions of years to seem even slightly possible. There are many, many dating methods and processes that seem to indicate a very young Earth. Some of the methods that point to a very young Earth are population statistics, moon dust, and the Earth's magnetic field. Population statistics, at the rate that the population of the world is doubling, if you take that same, I believe it's doubling at a geometric rate, if you go back in time and assume that rate was constant, which is what uniformitarianism demands, it takes you right back to about the time of the traditional date of Noah's flood. So, you know, it takes you about, I think, 4300 BC or something along those lines. So, population statistics, if everything continues at the same rate, the same processes, then you would expect the population of men to continue at the same rate. And if the evolutionists were true, if we've been around as long as they claim we have, this planet wouldn't be able to hold all the human beings that there would be. Moon dust. Now there was a not too long ago. Well, actually about a year or two ago, there was a big paper written supposedly refuting this argument. But there was a time that, since the moon was a dead planet, didn't have the ocean and wind like Earth does, and space dust would just collect on it. So it was assumed, if it was, you know, millions of years old, that there would be so much dust collected that when Apollo 11? Apollo 11, and it was in 69, that's right. When it landed on the moon, they had invested millions of dollars just in case it was going to sink deep into the dust, the space dust on the moon, they had ways to get around that and spend millions of dollars because they expected that to occur.
That's the reason the landers in two stages instead of a single stage. They leave the legs on the moon because they were thinking that they were going to be 4 or 5 feet into the dirt.
Yeah. See, and there was even some speculation. In fact, Neil Armstrong had stated that his number one fear going up there was that he would get stuck in space. Space does not be able to get out. But there was even some who were speculating. I don't know if it was over 100 feet of space dust, but there was some calculations that were saying that there might be that much. Then they get up to space, they couldn't even pound the American flag in. They had such a hard time pounding the American flag into the moon because there was only a few thousand years worth of space dust. Now they've come up with some kinds of theories that were usually they were ridiculed in the early stages as kind of space vacuums that would suck the dust out off of dead planets and dead space objects, but now there appears to be some kind of truth to it. But whether or not it would pull off what needs to be pulled off to keep the moon that clean, I don't know.
Well, one of the other theories is that the vacuum would be so intense at the surface, because it is basically a pure vacuum at the surface of the moon, that it would force the dust to solidify. And I can't remember, I don't know the mechanism behind it. It was way over my head when I read it. But
did it seem like it was something that the scientific community would see? And the other thing is, too,
it didn't seem like it was getting a lot of support.
And the other thing is, if it does get a lot of support, the question comes up,
why?
Is it getting a lot of support because it makes sense, or is it getting a lot of support because there's no other way to refute a young Earth and a young solar system? The Earth's magnetic field... the Earth's magnetic field, if you go back in time, it was getting stronger, I believe.
Yeah.
And so if you go back beyond 20,000 years, it would be too strong to sustain life, to support life on Earth. So that's another strong argument for a very young Earth. And then, they might argue, well, they believe that it gets stronger as you go back in time, but then if you go further back in time, it starts getting weaker. In other words, it's... it's oscillating. Well, the problem is, how do you fit that in with a uniformitarian assumption that the processes remain constant?
They haven't been able to propose any mechanism by which the magnetic field would be able to charge itself to a strong level and then begin decaying.
And even if so it's kind of that the magnetic field. That argument is a strong argument because they're basically damned if they say it remains constant. Then they can hold on to uniformitarianism, but then it seems to say, well, then there was no life more than 20,000 years ago on the planet. So then they can say, okay, well, then it oscillates. But then the problem is, once you say it oscillates, what does that do for uniformitarianism? Because every other process that you're using, whether it's radioactive decay, every other rate could also possibly oscillate as well. You don't know which ones do and which ones don't. So uniformitarianism is basically, it's a dogmatic assumption that is made, but the fact of the matter is it's just an assumption. It doesn't disprove. See, evolution does not disprove creation. It assumes creation didn't happen, and then it speculates as to how things could happen, and the evidence is mounting against it. But even having said that, even an old Earth does not refute the creation model. Now, I believe there'd be some theological and hermeneutical problems with the first two chapters of Genesis. In fact, the first three chapters of Genesis, but it would not refute the creation model. Hugh Ross is an old Earther. I think he gives excellent scientific arguments for an old Earth, and I sure wouldn't want to debate him on the subject. He's a scientist, and I'm not. At the same time, when he tries to give theological justification for an old Earth and for man being here for years, it sounds weak to me that before Adam and Eve fell in the garden, you can have millions upon millions of dead fossilized animals. It seems to me that animals wouldn't die until after the fall. Now, Adam and Eve did eat plant life, what we call plant life, but the Bible wouldn't call plants living beings. I believe you have to have some type of a soul to be a living being, and I believe even animals have souls. They're referred to as souls in the Hebrew. And I don't think that that means that they have life after death or anything along those lines. But just to have sense experience, it takes more than just molecules in motion. Just to have sense experience at all would take some type of a soul, an immaterial aspect of the being. The fossil record turns out to be another problem for evolution, which is really ironic because many people assume that the fossil record proves evolution, but in actuality, the fossil record shows no evidence of missing links, no transitional forms. New life forms appear suddenly and fully developed in the fossil record. You don't see half fins or half wings, you know, a fin or a wing turning into an arm. You don't see that, okay? Matter of fact, I believe it's, what is it again that the fish are supposed to have evolved into reptiles?
Well, fish, amphibian, reptile.
Okay, because to go from one to the other, you've got a totally different type of lung. One is two.
From fish to amphibian, you have to change lungs.
Yeah.
You go from gills to lungs.
Okay.
And then to go from amphibian to reptile, you got to change your lungs again.
And the whole makeup is like totally different. I mean, we're not talking like different types of TV sets. We're talking like going from a television to a radio to achieve the same purpose, breathing. So the fact of the matter is, if you had like, you know, half and half, you would not be able to breathe. Most organs do not work unless they're fully developed. So how are you going to have a transitional form existing for, if you hold a punctuated equilibrium, 20 to 100,000 years, and if you're a Darwinian evolutionist, maybe upwards closer to a million years, how are you going to have a transitional form existing for a million years when its lungs haven't fully developed yet, so it can't breathe? For a species that cannot breathe for a million years. That's ludicrous. And that, by the way, was the type of thing that Darwin suggested. If you prove this type of thing, you've totally destroyed my theory. And we see many cases of that, where if one organ was just in transition, that species would just die out immediately. But the fossil record actually could point to a worldwide flood. Number one, fossilization is extremely rare today. Even if you had millions of years, you would not have the extent of fossilization that we have today just at the normal rate. The fossilization is extremely rare today, and if fossilization occurred at the same rate throughout all time, you would need more than millions and more than billions of years to bring about the fossil record we have today. However, fossils are caused by rapid burial. And this, by the way, is exactly what a worldwide flood would do. We have worldwide fossilization, and the Bible teaches that we had a worldwide flood. In fact, the first scientist to examine the fossil record were Bible believers, and the more they looked into it, the more that they felt they were looking at an effect caused by the worldwide flood. The reason why you need a rapid burial is the thing has to be buried so quick that it doesn't have time to decay, so that it would leave a fossil. So a worldwide flood would do that. What was that, John?
Do you have any names on some of those scientists?
What was the guy's name? Lyle? Was that the first guy, the father of I don't know if he's the book to get is Origin Science by guys where they go through the whole chapter and the whole history of modern science, and they show not only that these guys were Christians or Bible believers, but why they viewed the evidence as favoring creation rather than against it. Even Gregor Mendel, the father of modern genetics, he experimented with plants and that type of thing. And he argued, yes, for the variation, but within limits. And those limits defined what the species were.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the guy that got the ball, all the great men that got the ball rolling, that made the great movement forward to get their field of science off the ground, each one of them had to assume creation just to get to that point. And basically, the whole basis of their system was based on creationism. But you can even argue, like, I don't even remember the name of the author, but the book, The Atheist Syndrome, that when you compare, you talk to evolutionists, and Charles Darwin was the greatest scientist of the 19th century. But when you compare his work, his accomplishments, with Louis Pasteur, or any of the other leading scientists who were Christians, they blew doors on the atheist. And so it's almost like if you want to be an evolutionist, fine, and a dogmatic evolutionist, fine, but you're never going to really accomplish anything. You might improve on certain things that are being done, but you're not going to establish something new. You're not going to boldly go where no one else went before, because you've got a few dogmatic beliefs that are going to stifle science. In other words, you're just refusing to accept a certain number of facts that could further your own branch of science. But the canopy theory, in fact, take a look at Genesis 1:6-8. 1 verses 6 to 8. John, that's the first book of the Bible. If you don't have a Bible, here's one, John. Make sure I get it back. It's the New Adventure Bible, the NIV Study Bible for kids, and John. Ooh, that was, for those listening on the cassette, that was my head that collided with the desk.
The desk is okay, though.
Okay, Genesis 1, verses 6 to 8, that reads, "Then God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse, and separated the waters which were below the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse, and it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening, and there was morning a second day." Now, when you look at verse 1, it says, "In the beginning God created the heavens," plural, "and the earth." When you read throughout the scriptures, you find the scriptures talks about three heavens. Paul said he was caught up to the third heaven, the throne room of God. So that's the third heaven. The second heaven is the entire universe except for the earth and its atmosphere. David said, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the work of his hands." He's talking about the stars and the rest of the universe. But the first heaven is discussed in other passages, where the birds flying around, the clouds and that type of thing, the earth's atmosphere. And this is the heaven that is being spoken of. You have God, he creates the universe, and the world is just a bunch of water, and he takes the water above from and separates it from the water below, the water that's still on the earth, with an expanse which is the earth's atmosphere. Now, we know today that the ozone layer filters out poisonous rays from the sun, and these poisonous rays from the sun have a great effect on the aging process of man. In fact, if you stay out in the sun too long, you can get wrinkles early on in life, okay? So there's all this concern about the ozone layer. But imagine if you had 40 days and 40 nights worth of water completely surrounding the Earth's atmosphere. Right now, there's only enough water to surround the Earth's atmosphere that if it flooded the entire Earth, it'd only flood it 1 inch all the way around. The reason why you get big local floods is a large portion of that water converges in one area. But if you just had the whole entire Earth, it would only be 1 inch of water. That's a big argument used against a worldwide flood. Where would the water come from? Or where is the water? Well, I'll tell you where the water is. Just go swim in the ocean. That's where the water is. In Genesis 6, verses 11 to 12, it shows how much water was up there. And this would filter out the poisonous rays of the sun, so it would slow down the aging process of man. And lo and behold, the Bible says that before the flood, men used to live to be over 900 years old. Now, reptiles continue to grow until they die. Okay? We've got some crocodiles that are 30 feet long alive today. Well, can you imagine if they were able to live 10 times as long as they live right now? Maybe a good portion of our dinosaurs may not have grown extinct. And, of course, before the flood, you've got the plant life is much more wholesome, and that could grow bigger elephants and mammoths and that type of thing. Yeah.
One thing I've heard talk to people in Africa, they said when the alligator eats right amount of food and vegetation, the gas is so flammable that it ignites
the human lips. Yeah, and it's the old legends of fire-breathing dragons and that type of thing. We do have, I think, off the coast of Australia, or on the coast of Australia, there are some. I think they're crocodiles that will at times ignite a flame from the gases of their stomach. So the fire-breathing dragon type. In fact, we have legends of. Well, we call them legends, but they're probably historical accounts of dinosaurs in the 1500s being killed by men for sport because they were so happy that by that time they had gotten so small that men were no longer intimidated by them. But the worldwide flood would explain an awful lot of the data. In fact, in Africa, there's still what we used to call brontosauruses. There's still smaller ones over there in some places that tribes that had no evolutionary education have identified, picking them out of a group of snapshots and that type, or drawings as snapshots, group of drawings and stuff. Genesis 6 verses 11 and 12. I think that's supposed to be 7, 11 and 12. Yeah. Genesis 7, verses 11 and 12. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on the same day, all the foundations of the great deep burst open, and the floodgates of the sky were opened. The word in the Hebrew is the same word for heaven, I believe. Verse 12, and the rain fell upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. So you had 40 days and 40 nights worth of water, enough water to cover even the highest mountain, we're told, later on in Genesis, enough water to cover even the highest mountain. Well, look at verse 20 of Genesis 7. The water prevailed 15 cubits higher, and the mountains were covered. So first they were covered, it says in verse 19, and then it went 15 cubits higher. So about 45 or 50 feet higher than the highest mountain on earth. Okay? So that's a worldwide flood, according to the scriptures. So now this water comes down. Now the aging process of man would drop drastically. Now, Psalm 104. Were you raising your hand, Gary?
No.
Okay. I don't know why. You know, tonight, the whole night, every time in the corner of my eye, it looks like you're raising your hand. Psalm 104, 5 to 9. And this reads, he established the earth upon its foundations so that it will not totter forever and ever. Thou didst cover it with the deep as with a garment. The waters were standing above the mountains. At thy rebuke they fled. At the sound of thy thunder they hurried away. The mountains rose and the valleys sank down to the place which thou didst prepare for them. Thou didst set a boundary that they may not pass over, that they may not return to cover the earth. Now, most interpreters of the word, most students of the word, interpret this passage to be talking solely about God's creation. And I believe verse 5 is talking about God's creation. He established the earth upon its foundation, will not totter forever and ever. But once it talks about that he covered it with the deep, he covered it with water as a garment, and the waters were standing above the mountains, from verse 6 to verse 9, that has to be talking about the worldwide flood. The reason being, look down at verse 9, God determined that the water would not cover the earth ever and ever again. Okay? If this whole passage is talking about creation, then verse 9 God was wrong, because the mountains were covered again at a later time, the flood. So this is talking about the flood here. It was after the flood that God put the bow in the sky, the rainbow, and said that he would not flood the earth, would never be another worldwide flood again. Well, then what that tells us is that when the waters were standing above the mountains, verse 6, what caused dry land to come up was that, verse 8, the mountains rose and the valley sank down. Which means we live on the tops of mountains that protrude out of the water. Okay? That's why 3/4 of the earth's surface is water. That's why if the earth was a smooth sphere, it would be covered with water at a depth of almost 2 miles. Okay? So God caused... upheavals in the earth's crust would cause this, by the way. Mountains would rise, valleys would sink. Yeah.
But isn't there other verses in the Bible that use
the something like that? No, this is the clearest one. The problem with the NIV is a very good Bible, but I would recommend it as a reading Bible, not as a study Bible, because it was part of their goal. They wanted to be literal. It was a translation. But they also did take interpretive liberties to try to make the meaning more clear. For instance, the sons of God in the Old Testament, they only left it the sons of God once, and that's the one passage where guys disagree as to whether it means the angels of God. All the other times they translate the sons of God as the angels of God, and then it gives you the impression that therefore the sons of God in Genesis 6 couldn't have been angels. Well, when the Jews translated the Greek Old Testament into the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek and the Septuagint, they translated it as the angels of God. So they took some interpretive... literally, it reads a little rocky. I can't remember if the King James was the most literal here. I can't remember if that was, but when you read it literally, it sounds kind of weird, like it could go either way, but there was pretty much agreement. That it should be translated, the mountains rose, the valley sank down, but what exactly that means was in question, and so... The NIV went to tell. What did the NIV read there? Oh, just like it drained. Yeah, that doesn't really do it.
King James says, they go up by the mountain, they go down by the valley into the place which thou hast founded for you.
Okay. Yeah, and it's... I think here the New American Standard, when I did a study, I think the New American Standard was more literal. The problem is, unless you're thinking along the lines of tremendous upheavals in the earth's crust, it just doesn't sound like it makes sense. So a lot of them are thinking, well, the mountains don't go up and valleys don't sink. Therefore, it must be talking about the waters rolling down the mountains and into the valleys. But again, they're taking too... I think they're doing more interpreting than anything else. But what this does, this explains where all the water went. This also would let us know that a large portion of any overpopulation problems that we might have, which are greatly exaggerated, especially since studies have proven you can fit everybody in the world in one-third of Texas, and then leave the other one-third of Texas for parks and recreation, and then the other one-third for business. Everybody, we live in small cubicles, but you could do it. And so the problem isn't that we're running out of space. The problem is we're not faithful stewards. But even if the problem wasn't we were running out of space, if we didn't, we weren't so wicked and didn't mess up, God wouldn't have had to flood the earth to begin with. But this is an incredibly wet planet, and I think the canopy theory, a canopy of water around the earth that came down during the flood, would explain it. By the way, these upheavals in the earth's crust would explain the continental shifts that separated the continents from each other. It would also explain to a large degree how all the different parts of the world could be populated even before boats were designed and that type of thing. It would also explain a global ice age would be the next thing to follow a worldwide flood. Do you have your hand up? Man, I don't know what it is that I'm...
You know what he's doing? He's putting his hand up and then denying it.
Okay, but the flood, now for the fossil record, the flood would tend to bury fossils in this order. I got this information from Dr. Henry Morris. Deep ocean creatures would be buried first. Creatures in shallower water, basically they would get buried where they live, basically. And then the smarter animals that are living on higher ground to begin with could get to even higher ground, you know, just from common sense. Hey, everything else is underwater, I need to get higher. Deep ocean, they'd be buried in this order. Deep ocean creatures in shallower water, then amphibians and land bordering creatures, followed by swamp, marsh, and low river flat creatures, especially reptiles. That would be followed by higher mammals who retreated to higher ground, attempting to escape the flood, and last, humans would be overtaken. Now, when you look at that order, that's the same order that the evolutionists expect to find, but they're saying that these lower creatures evolved into these higher creatures, okay? Now, this is where I think the creation, the worldwide flood, is a better explanation here. The exceptions that are found, by the way, this is the rule. This order here is the rule for the fossil record. But there are so many exceptions to the rule that even some evolutionists question whether there should be a rule at all. Okay? I'm not even sure if half the time, this is the most common order you're going to find, but I'm not even sure if more than half the time you're going to find this order. There's always something shuffled out of order. But any exceptions in this order can be explained better by the flood. They'd be explained by upheavals in the Earth's crust after the flood. The mountains rising, the valleys sinking. It could take a whole layer and just rearrange everything to where you got one layer down, two layers lower than it's supposed to be.
Or if it's on a side or upside down.
Yeah. And if you've had these layers, if these layers came rapidly, you would expect to see polystrate trees sticking up through three or four layers. A whale on its tail, going over several layers of supposed millions of years of evolution. So the exception, if it was formed rapidly by a worldwide catastrophe, other effects of that worldwide catastrophe could explain a reshuffling, the exceptions to that order. As I mentioned, the global ice age would follow the flood. The evolutionists want the global ice age, but they don't want the worldwide flood. And then lack of vegetation would eventually kill off the dinosaurs after the flood. Job talks about behemoth and leviathan. Leviathan appears to be some type of fire-breathing type dragon that's in the waters. And people try to say it's a crocodile. Well, even Charles Ryrie tries to argue that it's a crocodile, but everybody... talking about an intimidating creature, and then it says when he raises up, men look on in fear. And that's the only thing that doesn't intimidate me about a crocodile is when they raise up, because they don't get to. I get higher off the ground than a crocodile does, and I'm not even 6 feet tall, so I'm just a shade under 6 feet tall. Okay, Johnny, drop your grade down to a B-minus again. Okay, and then Job also talks about behemoth. And by the way, Job is a good source, because here you got a conversation with Job and three of his buddies, and then another guy that's hanging around, a young kid. And you got like 40-some-odd chapters of a time period that goes back to probably a little bit before the time of Abraham. Whereas when you're getting the account of Abraham, you're getting it from Moses as given to him by God or passed down, and there's not a whole lot of details. So one of the most ancient writings, one of the most ancient sources of what the world was like that we can find is going to be Job. He even talks about cavemen. He basically said there were a bunch of idiots who were rebellious kids were too lazy to build a house, so they lived in the clefts of the rocks. But he not only talked about Leviathan, he talked about Behemoth. Behemoth, Charles Ryrie and most of Bible scholars try to claim, well, Behemoth is an elephant or a rhinoceros or a hippopotamus. They talk about it being real powerful loins, and he's in the water, but he's also on land and stuff, and described much like those other creatures. Well, the problem is, it also mentions that he swings his tail like a cedar tree. And look at the tail of an elephant, the tail of a hippopotamus, and the tail of a rhinoceros, and it is not a really intimidating tail. Okay, so it sounds like what we used to call a brontosaurus. And the reason why we changed the name to brontosaurus, they put the wrong skull. We were deceived as kids. You know, it's just really tough. But they put the wrong skull on the neck and the body of a different animal. The brontosaurus' head actually looked a little bit different. And so, his head came up a little bit more to a point, like my Doberman a little bit. So he looked a little different than the brontosaurus' head. It was a different type of a head. So now it's got an entirely different name that I can't pronounce. And it's just a real traumatic experience for all dinosaur fans. There's an 8.5 by 11 photo that I have, or a copy of a photo that Japanese fishermen. It was in some major, I don't know if it was Time or Newsweek magazine at one time too. Japanese fishermen off the coast of New Zealand. They reeled in a freshly decayed what appeared to be a plesiosaur, which looks like the old brontosaurus, only he's got fins instead of legs. Looks a lot like photos of the Loch Ness Monster stuff. But this was freshly decayed, and if one was still recently alive, that meant that there had to be others recently alive. Because of the way they reproduce, which is the way many species reproduce. But in fact, the Japanese, Jeff, stick with theology. What is it, 18,000 comedians out of work? But anyway, the Japanese nation even made a stamp out of it. It was so impressive and all. But African natives have also said that there's some type of something like what we used to call brontosauruses, but they're a lot smaller. And the people even said that they don't eat people. They just stamp them to death if you provoke them too much. And then there's legends of dinosaurs and that type of thing. And almost behind every legend, there's an element of truth. So there's good evidence that the evolutionary idea that dinosaurs ceased to exist long before man walked the earth. Even in the Paloxi River, they have found human footprints alongside dinosaur footprints. Norman Geisler points out that there have been some hoaxes there, but the original ones that were found in a riverbed, the human footprints were as authentic as the dinosaur. In other words, you either throw them both out or you accept them both as true, the dinosaur and the human footprints. And he said that the footprints were even more clear than Leakey's footprints, famous footprints of some supposed missing link. So there is good evidence that dinosaurs did coexist with man and did die out fairly recently. We didn't even know I don't know if it was a certain type of gorilla or gorillas in general, that it was in the mid-1800s when we found out that those things were alive. I mean, it's amazing how many species were supposed to be extinct in prehistoric times that we're finding. You know, we go to some island, all of a sudden, boom, there's one of them. And one little reptile probably fit in my hand was supposed to be extinct, you know, millions of years ago. And now those things are still alive. And so, you know, only the strong survive. That was classic Darwinism. So I guess this little guy is pretty tough.
So when's that be launching its safari to Africa to bring back the brontosaurus?
Well, our most recent, there's a ship. And an evacuated ship, an empty ship over there. PSS is supposed to be demon possessed. It's supposed to be haunted.
That's right. Well,
and so I'm trying to talk Doug into sleeping three nights there all alone and with the video camera.
That's right. Don't take Leakey with you.
Yeah. It's not a job for Leakey. Okay, mutations. Again, we talked about this earlier. They supposed to prove evolution or be the mechanism or the instrument used by evolution to the mechanism is a better word. Mechanism through which evolution occurred, but it does not prove evolution because evolution needs new genes. Mutations only alter already existing genes. And so Charles Ryrie's question, where did single-celled animals get genes for teeth, is a good question. I mean, if you only got 26 letters in your alphabet and you need a 27th letter, mutations won't give it to you. They just scramble the order of the letters. Okay? The supposed missing links between apes and men, you saw them. They're the naked guys that were in your college textbook that grew more and more hair until eventually at the end of the page you had a naked man. It starts out as a little monkey and stuff, and it shows great imagination, tremendous art, but it's really, really sad science. For some reason, the science textbooks, I think they're purposely, I mean, if they found out that Christopher Columbus committed adultery, they would probably tonight replace all the textbooks in colleges all over the country to make sure you know that this Western guy coming from Western Europe and from Christian civilization, that he was unfaithful to his wife. Yet when they find out that their missing links weren't really missing links, sometimes it takes them 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years and they still don't change their textbooks. Neanderthal man and Cro-Magnon man both have features of modern man and should be considered modern man. Colorado man turned out to be a member of the horse family. I mean, you know, a lot of times we think, you know, that because they draw a whole body, they put the hair on these things, there's no way to tell from bones. Oh, man, we're at the end already.